Morning. Great to be with you this morning. Looking forward to Joshua 22 and looking at that with you. I've really enjoyed getting to know you all and have really appreciated your kindness towards me and encouragement and your kind words from the lessons that you've been hearing. Especially glad that we got a chance to get to know each other at Larry's house, and I got to see how you interact with each other, and it's true what I suspected. You guys really seem to like each other, and that's a good thing. I'm glad to see that. This morning's lesson, and I apologize for not having a PowerPoint for you. Just something wasn't right about the structure of my outline. It just didn't seem to flow right, and so I was working pretty frantically yesterday because I had this vision of how I could make it better. And I just could not conform PowerPoint to it. But the benefit to you is that you don't have to write everything down that you're seeing. If you want to have access to something you've heard, I keep pretty detailed notes, and it's available to you. All you got to do is ask Larry, or maybe Irene has it, I think, my email. Am I right about that? All right. And I can send you these notes, and you can have access to it that way. You won't miss a single thing. But I wanted to start with a line that I read out of a commentary. And I know that's kind of a questionable practice. You don't often want to do that. But bear with me here. It's a short thing. And it has to do with when there is sin and false teaching in the church. The line goes, "There is a time for war, but war too often is the easy way out and becomes the first resort. God wants us to contend for the truth, but He also wants us to practice the truth by getting the facts, telling the truth, and believing one another. Overreaction can be just as harmful as no reaction." I'll especially like this last part. "Meat axes have done harm where a scalpel might have excised just the needed amount." I don't know if you can tell where we're going with that, if that makes sense. And I don't know what you've experienced in your life. Sometimes I wonder when I preach on this chapter, Joshua 22, if people will even appreciate, not that you won't appreciate the text, but if you'll have the experiences in life to really make application. Whether you have or not, you need to know what the text teaches, and you need to be prepared for it when it happens. But I'm telling you, I've seen things. I've been places, I've experienced things. And there's a lot of great application from this text. I'm really passionate about these conclusions and excited to share them with you. But Joshua 22 is a living reminder of the fact that conflicts within the church and the potential for brotherhood conflicts can so easily arise. And there is a proper recourse. There's a proper channel to follow when perhaps disconcerting information comes to light, or we hear reports about a brother. What are we going to do in those cases? And are we going to believe in our brethren? So let's just tell the story a little bit. Joshua 22 begins by saying, Joshua called the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, saying, "You have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and have obeyed my voice in all that I commanded you." Well, what's that all about? You may recall from Numbers chapter 32 that these 2.5 tribes had requested of Moses that they be permitted to remain on the east side of the Jordan River and not cross over to take their possession in the land of Canaan on the west side of the Jordan River. And Moses immediately jumps to the conclusion that they're acting the same way that the earlier generation had acted when at Kadesh Barnea the spies had said, "No, we shouldn't go in, we shouldn't fight." and let's just turn around and go back. So they are really quick to defend themselves, saying, no, that's not at all what we're trying to say here. We're just saying we really like this land. We're more than happy to go over and fight with you and to obtain this possession for Israel as God has promised. And so Moses says, if you do that, if all of you men of war cross over and fight, then you can obtain this possession on the east side, because it was good for their families, for their flocks. So here in verses 2 and 3, he says, you've kept all of that. You've done all that I commanded you. You've not left your brethren these many days up to this day, but have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God. Okay, these first 8 verses are about Joshua's final farewell message to Israel. And he declares here, of course, that they kept all that Moses had commanded. As he prepares to send them on their way to the east side of the Jordan, he warns them that they be very careful to keep the law when they go into the land and follow all of the law of Moses. And it says then that Joshua sent them on their way with much wealth. And so everything is great from verses 1 through 9 there. Then in verses 9 and 10, they depart to the east side of the Jordan River. And on the way back, they build an altar. And we're not told right here why that is done. But let's just notice what they did. Verse 10. When they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a great and impressive altar. Now the children of Israel heard someone say, behold, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the children of Israel's side. So we're going to see in a moment why this was. Just note for now that that's what they did. They built this altar, and it was on the children of Israel's side. They did it on the west side, the land of Canaan, where most of the tribes had intended to get their possession. So what is the response then? Verses 11 through 20. Israel hears this report, and they suit up for war, and they're ready to fight. And they've all come to gather together against their brethren when at the very last they send out delegates who approach the leaders of the tribes and say, verse 16, what treachery is this that you have committed against God of Israel to turn away this day from following the Lord? You've built yourselves an altar that you might rebel this day against the Lord. Is the iniquity of Peor not enough for us, from which we are not cleansed to this day, although there was a plague in the congregation of Israel? But that you must turn away this day from following the Lord. And it shall be, if you rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow He will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. Then in verse 20, he says, did not Achan, the son of Zerah, commit a trespass in the accursed thing, and wrath fell on the congregation of Israel? And that man did not perish alone in his iniquity. So they're ready to fight, and notice that there's not any inquiry here. They've already decided that what you're doing is tantamount. It's the equivalent of the iniquity of Peor. Remember that from Numbers chapter 25? You remember where Balaam attempted to cause God to curse Israel and concocted the plan of having Moabite women come in and tempt the men of Israel so that they would be found by God in sin and cursed because He couldn't curse them of His own. So they're equating it to what Balak and Balaam did here. They're equating it to the rebels who refused to follow Moses into to fight at Kadesh Barnea. And they're equating it to what Achan did in stealing from what was accursed or under the ban. And they're worried that their sin is going to be heaped up on them, that they're going to bear the guilt of this. And so that's why they say that they are acting. It was called treachery, it's called rebellion, it's called unfaithful and it's called trespass in this context. Well, 21 through 29, you've got the defense. You've got the response then by the 2.5 tribes. They defended themselves, explaining what was their original intention of having built this altar. Let's read together. Verse 21 says, "And the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half tribe of Manasseh answered and said to the heads of the divisions of Israel, 'The Lord, God of gods, the Lord, God of gods, He knows. And let Israel know itself. If it is in rebellion or if in treachery against the Lord, do not save us this day. If we've built ourselves an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if to offer on it burnt offerings or offerings on it, let the Lord Himself require an account.'" You see, you couldn't just build an altar and offer sacrifices to the Lord wherever you wanted. God had said that He would choose the place from which His name would go forth and offerings would be made. And they recognized that if that's what we did, then the Lord Himself should require an account of us. But in fact, we have done it for fear, for a reason, saying, "In time to come, your descendants may speak to our descendants, saying, 'What have you to do with the Lord, God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between you and us, your children, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad. You have no part in the Lord.' So your descendants would make our descendants cease fearing the Lord. Therefore we said, 'Let us now prepare to build ourselves an altar, not for burnt offerings, not for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between you and us and our generations after us, that we may perform the service of the Lord before Him with our burnt offerings, with our sacrifices, with our peace offerings, that your descendants may not say to our descendants in times to come that you have no part in the Lord. Therefore we said that it will be when they say this to us or our generations in time to come that we may say, 'Here is the replica of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, though not for burnt offerings nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness between you and us. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn from following the Lord this day to build an altar for burnt offerings, for grain offerings, for sacrifices, besides the altar of the Lord our God, which is before His tabernacle.'" And fortunately, war was averted that day. The saying pleased them, as it says in verse 40. And it pleased the delegates. It pleased the people. They proclaimed that the Lord was in their midst, and they blessed God, as verse 33 says. And finally, interestingly enough, they got to keep their altar as a memorial, as a reminder or witness that these tribes on both sides of the Jordan were a part of the covenant of God. You might say, "Well, that sounds like a nice happy ending. What's the problem with this?" I see a big problem in it. I see that a lot of mistakes were made. A lot of mistakes that are often made today in the way we interact with other people. Because I want to talk about the real culprit of this story. If we go back and consider who's the real culprit of the story, it's really a man about whom we know virtually nothing. He's the man in verse 11. The man in verse 11, whoever it was that saw this altar being built and then dutifully ran back to report about what he had seen, instead of first having gone to find out what is going on here. He observed that it was happening, and for whatever reason thought that the appropriate response would be to go and tell. To go and tell on people. We're not informants. As brethren, we're not informants against other brothers. In fact, you may recall that Jesus addressed this kind of issue in Matthew chapter 18, verse 15, where He says, "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother." Now, I recognize some may object to using that because Jesus said if he sins against you, this wasn't actually against you. What are we saying then? Where are we going with that? Are you saying that as long as it's not personally against me, I don't really have any obligation toward my brother? If Matthew 18:15 isn't good for you in this application, then how about Matthew 7, verse 12? How about the golden rule? How about however you want to be treated, so you treat other people? If someone sees you doing something that they believe is sinful, is that what would you like to happen in that case? You want them to go tell other people? You want them to go report on you to the elders, tell them what they saw? Or do you want them to come to you, as they ought to try to see if they can restore their brother? Now, even I'm not suggesting here that he should have seen this and ignored what he was concerned about. I think that's an important point to make. However, he didn't need to go play informant. You know, there are so many passages that give instruction and advice and commands. Proverbs appeal to us based on the better way of doing things. The better way, in Proverbs chapter 18, verse 13, he who answers a matter before he hears it, it is a folly and a shame to him. We draw conclusions before we have all of the facts. He says it's a folly and shame. So that's Proverbs chapter 18, 13. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 14, this is especially applicable because it has to do with the context of brethren going off into idolatry and how they should handle that. He says, corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods which you've not known. Well, what do you do in that instance? Then you shall inquire, search out, and ask diligently. If it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you, then you shall surely strike. So you take great pains to seek out diligently to ensure that you have all of the facts. In Job chapter 29, verse 16, Job is actually, as he makes his defense about the kind of man he is and his character and why it was unjust that he was having to suffer these things, he says of himself that I was a father to the poor and I searched out the case that I did not know. That was important, Job. When he didn't have all the facts, he says, I looked into it and I tried to discover what was the truth. Even Nebuchadnezzar stands out as an example of a man that was not willing to decide a case before he had heard it. In Ezekiel chapter 3, the report had come to the king against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that they do not serve your gods, O king, or worship the gold image which you have set up. And in a rage, even Nebuchadnezzar in rage and fury is better than this anonymous man who went and told on his brother. Because he brought them before the king here, and it says in 3 verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Is it true? That's all I'm suggesting. Is that we get to, before we draw conclusions, that we get to the bottom of what has happened. In John chapter 7, verse 51, even Nicodemus also, as he in a stealthful way attempts to defend Jesus without actually coming out and being a disciple, Nicodemus, he who came to Jesus by night, being one of them, said to them, does our law judge a man before it hears him? and knows what he is doing. And so let's mark that down. I've given you a number of passages that establish this truth, that we need to be careful to gather all of the facts. Without taking these steps, without going through this process, but by just going to spread the matter, we become a talebearer at that point. The Scriptures talk about the talebearer. In Proverbs chapter 11, verse 13, it warns us against being one that goes around telling on people, essentially. A talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is of a faithful spirit conceals a matter. Now, this deals with things that are of a private nature and not one concerning such a public action as this building of an altar. But the same kind of spirit can overwhelm a person who has something to tell, be it a public or a private nature. We need to watch ourselves that when we hear information about a brother or about a church, that we not, you know, some people really enjoy sharing that, and it almost like it's a pleasure for them to be able to spread this news. And we need to make sure, first of all, is it true? Have we tried to discover whether or not there's any truth there? Proverbs 26, verse 20 also says, where there is no wood, the fire goes out, and then when there is no talebearer, strife ceases. So I share that with you. Not to suggest that he should have just kept a lid on it, but that he should have stopped the truth. You know, we preachers can be really bad at this too, and I recognize that. We can be some of the worst offenders when it comes to being slanderers or being gossips, talebearers. The word for talebearer is defined by some sources as a scandalmonger, as traveling about, a slanderer, or an informer. And I recognize the danger of the preacher luncheon or those private meetings where preachers get together and talk, and it hasn't always been healthy. We've fallen into the same trap. Now, let's go back and consider how would we respond in this situation. Like, let's say, for example, when receiving an accusation. Let's say that I'm part of the tribes on the west side, and I'm hearing from this talebearer, this man that refused to go and talk to his brother to sort out the situation. What is the first line of action? Well, if I'm receiving an action against a brother, if I'm on that receiving end, well, it sounds maybe kind of like what Christians were told, what Timothy was told by Paul and Timothy. He was told, don't receive an accusation against an elder except with against witnesses. But even according to the law, we know the accusations weren't to be received against the nation, against members of the nation, the sons of Israel, without there being proper guidelines. There needed to be witnesses. And you didn't just decide someone was guilty without there being at least two witnesses to the crime. So we would insist that proper guidelines be met. When you're on the receiving end of accusations against a brother, you might just want to stop a person right there and make sure that they've followed the proper channels here. For example, consider the woman in John 8 that was brought and thrown at the feet of Jesus. And here is this woman that was charged of having committed adultery. And instead of Jesus just relying on his divine knowledge of the facts, the woman never says, Lord, I didn't do it. Jesus does say, go and sin no more. But before that, he says, where are your accusers? Where are your accusers? Who is it that saw you do this? Also, there's no sign of the man, of course, either. And so I think when Jesus says, he who is without sin, let him cast the first stone, I think he's trying to convict these people of their sin here. But notice that Jesus, he wanted to follow the proper channels as well when it came to convicting someone of sin. So what would that look like? It would be, have you gone to talk to this brother about this? It doesn't matter if I'm just a regular old member, or I'm a preacher, or I'm an elder. If we're dealing with a with an with a exchange between brethren, even an elder needs to say, well, you need to go talk to them about that. And I'd be happy, you know, if it doesn't go well, or if it, you know, somehow it isn't resolved, I'd be happy to be a witness for you if you need that after. You go try this first so that you can win your brother, and maybe he'll hear you, and then it'll be settled between you and him alone. The second thing that we need to do, besides making sure that people follow the proper channels, is to not be hasty in judgment. As the children of Israel did, they suited for war. They got in their battle array and went to prepare for battle before they even knew the facts. And so we don't jump to conclusions about things that we hear or even things that we see. Again, seen these things happen among brethren. We have brothers that are ready to go to war also, but it's not, of course, physical battle. We're much more laid back than that, but we're still going to war. It might be in the comfort of my own home office, or as I sit in front of my computer, but I'm still going to war, and I'm ready to fight and ruin reputations and expose and name and write people up. Many times, not even having done any legwork here to discover whether or not the accusations against a brother are true. I sat in a luncheon one time. We went to lunch with Barry and I did, Barry Kirchville in Arkansas, a guy I was training to preach with. We went out to lunch with a couple of other preachers, and I'll just let you know ahead of time that the church in Fayetteville was getting torpedoed for the practice of having Bible classes in individual homes on Wednesday nights. You know, the church would meet in various homes to hopefully invite friends to study the Bible from their community. Well, they were just getting written up all over the place and accused of dividing the brethren. And when it came down to it, it was just something that was different that people weren't used to and they didn't like. And apologies have since been made, but the significant thing about, actually not from this brother with whom we were eating, we ate lunch with these two preachers, and it was just kind of a friendly lunch for the entire hour, and they were getting ready to get up and leave, and say our goodbyes and go our separate ways. When Barry says, wait a minute, let me talk to you about that article you just published about the church there and what we're doing. I think maybe we should try to get to the bottom of it. Okay, so we're there 30 more minutes and we're talking about this. And it just struck me that here, we just had lunch with these brothers. And for an hour, they had an opportunity to ask about what it is that they've been hearing. The brother even admitted that he had planned later in that week to preach and to name this preacher Barry and the church in this future lesson. An opportunity to talk with him at lunch, never mentions it, but he's going to go preach about it in a couple of weeks. Something wrong with this picture. Our goal needs to be restoration. Our goal needs to be trying to speak the same thing and to be reconciled with our brother instead of being so quick to turn and attack and go enter into attack mode. When we find ourselves in the role of having to confront a brother, how should we do that? Let's say we're the delegates. Okay, we're back to the delegates of the story in Joshua 22. They come. I got a problem with the approach, okay? Again, we've jumped to a conclusion here. But Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1 says, when there is a brother who is caught up in some trespass, how should you approach him? He says, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Spirit of gentleness. That's what the decree is. You do it gently. You don't go in guns a-blazin'. You don't go in leveling accusations. I think we did well when we coined the phrase innocent until proven guilty in our country. that these guys had already followed, they had become judge, jury, and were prepared to be executioners before even having heard what had happened. Well, verses 2 and 3 of chapter 22 reminds me of another question, and that is it fair to call somebody Achan? Is it fair to call somebody being in the likeness of Zimri or Cosby, who in the days of Peor tried to cause the stumbling block? Is that fair to treat brethren with whom you had just fought, and they had courageously fought with you, and they had dealt faithfully, so that Joshua is able to say, you have kept all of Moses' commandments, you have done all that he commanded, you've kept the charge? Is this any way to treat brethren with whom you have worked side by side, arm in arm? How quickly, again, we are to just throw people under the bus. What about if I find myself in the position of the 2.5 tribes? What if I'm the one being confronted? How should I approach that situation? How should I act when I'm on the receiving end of human judgment, even if I don't feel like it's fair? I'm impressed with the graciousness here, the attitude of the 2.5 tribes. Though unjustified, there's a lot of patience here. They're not interrupting. They're not cutting them off. They're not answering with anger. It's like the proverb says in chapter 15, verse 1, a soft answer turns away much wrath. And that there is a right way to use knowledge. They had knowledge of their innocence. They could have used that knowledge to hurt, to injure, to really, I guess we would say, to zing. It says a harsh word stirs up anger, but a soft answer turns away wrath. The tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly. You know, there's a wrong way to use knowledge. There's a wrong way to take something that is true and use it against people. And they easily could have done that. They could have come. They could have excoriated them for their attitude. Say, you can just hear this. You don't have a clue what you're talking about. They could have elevated the situation. It could have caused a rift here. Instead, they very respectfully, very humbly, they acknowledged that they had listened. You know, you read books today about how to get along with people, how to interact in an interpersonal way in the corporate world. You get criticism from people. The first thing they recommend you doing is say, thank you for bringing that to my attention. Let me make sure that I've understood you correctly. You know, and then you're kind of repeating their case. It goes a long way. That's exactly what they do. They say, yeah, exactly. We are in total agreement there. And if that's what's happened, let it be so. Just a great example for how to act when you're being confronted. And then once they were sure that they understood the charges, they were then able to patiently explain the real reason behind that altar. So they sought for reconciliation, not escalation. All right, so let's jump to the end of the story then. And I'm quickly running out of time, so we'll expedite that. When restoring a brother, we believe in them. We rejoice with them. It says it pleased them. It would be very easy for them to be suspicious. It would be very easy for them to say, you know what? We don't really believe that. Or to say, well, we're just going to have to watch a little closely here and keep them under a cloud of suspicion. I want to just share something with you from the New Testament about the real danger behind this. And the fact is that they didn't believe in their brother. They did not put the best possible motive on what they had seen. They did not try to understand or even to consider whether or not there was another explanation. In chapter 6 of verse 4 of 1 Timothy, he warns against those who are proud, who know nothing, or obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, from which come envy, strife, reviling, and evil suspicions. Evil suspicions. We must never let that be the case among brethren, that we are suspicious of one another. We don't have a charge. We're not aware of a claim of something that's been done that was sinful or wrong. But we've got this cloud of suspicion that we allow ourselves to think of them under. You might hear it this way. You know, that church over there, I don't know, there's just something not right about it. Something's, I can't really put my finger on it. They do things different over there. They speak of maybe as red flags. Well, what's the red flag? What are they doing? I don't know. It's just this, I can't really put my finger on it sort of thing. And, you think when you ask, well, what are they doing, that they should be able to identify something. This is the kind of thinking that says, well, where there's smoke, there's usually fire. That's when you hear that, you just go ahead and mark it down. We're dealing with suspicion and being suspicious of brethren. So with one trite statement after another, we cast aspersion as we can without really having anything tangible to charge a brother with. And we need to reject that kind of thinking and not receive it from other people. Another important point is that we do need to be careful when we're perhaps on the other side of the issue to provide honorable things to men. And I can appreciate, after everything that Israel had gone through, their sensitivity to that matter. You know, like 2 Corinthians 8 tells us that we should provide honorable things in the sight of all men. And you know what? They probably should have gone and spoken and had good communication with their brethren and said, hey, we're worried about this. What do you guys think about us building a memorial here? And we could have averted this whole thing. So let's be real about that and be aware of other brethren and how they might feel about things. So that's also important. The other thing that I wanted to share with you is the need to indeed be set for the defense of the gospel, as the tribes were, Philippians 1 verse 17, but not at the expense of our believing in our brethren and being suspicious of them. And the last thing, the one final thought that I wanted to share with you is taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 4 verse 5. 1 Corinthians 4, 5, Paul warns us that we judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsel of the hearts. I'm thankful that God does not require me and is not expecting me to become the judge and the jury and the executioner in all things related to brotherhood activities. He's promised that he would take care of that. Now, we don't turn a blind eye to sin, of course. But at the same time, we don't judge before the time. That is before the facts come out and before we're sure that we have them. All I know to do when things come up is to be like Paul and always expect the best and hope for the best. You may recall from 1 Corinthians chapter 13 that love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Love never fails. Let us ensure that we always do that with regard to our brethren. Thank you for listening.